write this down. Paul Pierce is the mother truth.
And welcome to the Truth Radio Show, part of the Almighty Baller Radio Network, down with Dash. This is the truth. I'm James Holis. Deep in the playoffs, you know, the playoffs are here. The real season has begun, it's kicked off. And somehow my Boston Celtics are trailing again the 8th seed Chicago Bulls. But it's whatever, right? Special guest today, senior NBA editor at FanSided, Ian Levy, as seen on ESPN, the Hickory High OG, and one hell of an American. Ian, what's up, brother?
Nothing. Happy to be on. Thanks for having me.
No, man. I appreciate you taking the time. I actually saw you flash across the timeline, and I was like, oh, crap, he is on ESPN. That's dope. I've been following you for a long time, and, you know, I kept everyone. Hickory High was like a cult classic. We want it back. I don't know. So, how's it going over at FanSided, man?
It's good. Yeah, it's been an exciting year. This was my first season. I actually just passed the one-year anniversary there. I started on the first day of the playoffs last year. So kind of got my feet wet during the playoffs last year. This was my first full season running the NBA show there. It was fun. We learned a lot, made some mistakes, swimming upstream on a couple things. But I like what we're doing. I like FanSided a lot. And, yeah, I'm excited about the future.
That's what's up, man. I'm just waiting for that DM telling you, you know, from you telling me that you invite me to come work for you guys. I dig it. I'm just waiting. I'm very patient. There's no rush. You do really good stuff, and you also do stuff in Island Calculus. We'll talk about some of the things you've done. I got beef with you for one reason, though. And
yeah.
We're gonna kick it off. You did a really nice piece, NBA Playoff 2017, the definitive playoff playlist. Now, I give you credit. You did tell us right off from the get-go you had bad taste in music.
Right? I sure do.
So everybody out there, check him out. It's at fansided.com. You can find it. Or you can probably just Google NBA Playoff 2017 definitive playlist, you'll find it. So yeah, we got beef, man. I love your work, but we're gonna just touch on it real quick. I guess you're obviously like me. We're not rookies to this. We've been around for a while. So some of your music is I'm trying to think of a good word without insulting you.
You can go all in.
No, man.
I got tough skin.
I bet you had a lot of fun doing this. I hope you remember. I mean, you have to remember. So basically, you wanted to give the people reading and people who know you something to listen to go along with these playoffs. You know that, and I don't get you, dude. Okay, so like for instance, tell them what songs you picked for Russell Westbrook.
I said Neil Diamond.
So I'm gonna be totally honest. I never heard this song before in my life. And when I clicked on play, first of all, he's talking about New York a lot in the song. That's what kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, there's some geographic references in there that don't quite line up. This song always used to make me think about LeBron James because to be honest, I don't even know that much about the lyrics or, like, you know, I don't know the story of the song or what it's supposed to mean or whatever. But, like, when I listen to it, I think about it's, like, this idea that that you can be whatever you want just by saying it. Like, the power of like, personal affirmation or whatever. Like, if you say I'm great, then you are great, you know, and sort of, like, how that works. And so it used to always make me think about, like, LeBron James and about how, like, the world saw him one way, he saw himself another way, and he was like, I'm just going to be, you know, I'm going to live who I think I am, and that will make me, you know, who I think I am or who I want to be. And it seems like it doesn't apply to him anymore, or is not quite interesting in the same way now that he's, he sort of confirmed his narrative, winning in the finals last year. I don't think people are arguing in the same way about his legacy, although people will argue about anything. So just thinking about Westbrook this year and about how, you know, going into the season, he was just, you know, he was trying to live out, you know, the idea of the way he saw himself. And, you know, he sort of had to share that with Kevin Durant for so long. And it was like, you know, this year is my chance to just be the Westbrook that I think I am, or, you know, that I see, you know, when I look in the mirror. And so I don't know. That was where the song came. But I will admit, lining up Neil Diamond with NBA probably appeals to a pretty, pretty niche audience.
I mean, yeah, if you were talking about Tim Duncan, I would dig it, you know, or talking about I don't know who's 80 years old in the NBA still. Jason
Vince Carter now.
Yeah, like Jason Terry, I guess. I don't know. But all right, so I had a couple suggestions. For one, I mean, it's really cliche, that whole "Now I Do What I Want" song. If you've seen that, the commercial, yeah. Right? That's a good one for him. And I found "California Bound" by Carolina Liar. And if you guys never heard it, go check it out. And that makes me think of Russ. That's Cali all day, and that's Russ. Another one for the Bucks. Dude, what is that song?
I don't even remember what I had. Was it the Tom Petty song?
Running Down a Dream by Tom Petty, dude. I started this video, and Giannis would be offended that you picked this song for his Bucks, man.
Well, I'm sure probably none of the players had heard any of the songs I picked. I will admit, I am one of those guys who am 35. I'll be 36 this summer, but I my taste in music was sort of like set in concrete, you know, when I was like a junior in college. That was sort of like when I stopped listening to new music. So yeah, everything
like
sounds
a, you gotta taste everything like a 55-year-old man.
Yeah, there you go.
I wanted to update that a little bit. I hit play on all these songs, and they're good music. I like it. It's just not, look, the Bucks are trying to make some noise in the playoffs. They're not here to play around. You know what I mean?
Cool.
Thank you for not laughing at the typos. I see I got a couple typos in the rundown I sent you. So thanks for not making fun of me. But when you get a chance, or you might even know the song, I want you to go listen to the song I picked for the Bucks. I picked "Knuck If You Buck" by the Crime Mob.
Right? Yeah.
So I want you to make sure you listen to that one. It's a song that, like, if you were in the gym listening to "Knuck If You Buck" and your max was 250, you'd bench 500. It's one of those songs. It's one of those songs that if you go to certain clubs or night spots and that song comes on, you want to exit the dance floor because things are about to get rowdy. All right, so
yeah,
and that's Giannis right now. He's unstoppable. So mm-hmm. "Knuck If You Buck" by Crown. So
all right.
Again, for the and so let's go on for the Jazz. Oh my goodness! Remember what you picked for the Jazz?
that Charlie Hunter song. I tried to go some real jazz. No, maybe not real jazz.
I didn't know. Yeah, I've never heard this song before. And I was, which song did you pick for the Jazz? Where'd it go? That's AC/DC. Oh, "No Money, No Honey" by Charlie Hunt. What?
No, well, admit it, though. If they had jazz in Utah, that's what it would sound like, right?
You're absolutely probably right. If they had jazz in Utah, you know what? What they'd have in Utah, it'd be like Vanilla Ice. A lot of Barry White. Very probably homogenous. No, seriously though, I picked a good song. But your song's fine. I picked because it's such a defensive presence, and you know, you probably heard the song too. Kanye West, "Love Lockdown." It has a nice solid bass line. Doom doom doom. Nice solid bass. Nice consistent beat, and "Love Lockdown." They love to play defense. They lock you down in Utah. Next time, call me when you need to start this kind of article, man. I won't steer you wrong.
Yeah, I should have gotten some advice before I dove in.
Nah, and then last one I really wanted to do is for the Celtics, you had, what's it called, In the Middle? That's actually a pretty good song. I like that one. That was actually a good choice. This is one I wouldn't argue with you too much about. The by Jimmy Eat World, The Middle. I've heard this song before. I didn't know what it was called. It's a pretty dope song. I just wanted to, you know, tweak it a little bit, of course, and give it my own flavor. So I said, for that one, because you were absolutely right, the Celtics do have a certain amount of pressure on them. You know, they didn't make moves at the trade deadline, and now they're feeling it. So, you know, let's go with Queen, "Under Pressure." You know?
Yeah, that's a great pick.
Yes.
Especially watching them tonight.
Oh man, they really are under pressure, right?
Their
back's against the wall, man. They're 24 minutes away from being down 0-2, you know, to the 8 seed. That's not a good look. Not a good place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I said, and for the bonus, if the Wizards end up flaming out, Scotty Doesn't Know from was that Eurotrip?
Yeah, I wish I thought of that. That's genius. I do. I remember that song. It's Matt Damon singing that, or at least in the movie it is. I don't know if somebody else sings it.
Yeah, it's another group. That was Matt Damon was awesome. I didn't realize it was him until I rewatched that movie years later. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you also wrote some stuff. We're going to actually hop into some real basketball talk now.
Sure.
People had enough of us messing around. you wrote something on the Cavs Patriots game one, and you brought something to my attention that I didn't realize. Larry Bird last summer, he wanted to get modern, right? He wanted to modernize the offense. He got rid of, the old, out with the old, in with the new. He tried, at least. And the original plan was to make Paul Pierce play power forward. And it's funny because we saw Paul Pierce stared him down. I mean, not Paul Pierce. Paul George stared him down, right? He was like, I'm not playing power forward. And first Bird was like, you don't make decisions around here. Well, obviously he does. And he didn't play power forward. And that's fine. Now, my problem with Bird not talking to Paul George before he came up with the whole cockamamie plan. He wanted to speed it up, and then he hired Nate McMillan somehow. But you brought up an interesting stat. The Pacers only have five guys who shot at least 35% from three and at least four three-point attempts per 100 possessions. Cleveland has 10 of those guys. That seems like trouble. I mean, we know the three-pointer is where it's at. Is there anything you can see in this series that the Pacers could do to at least make it competitive? Anything? Because it's been close the first two games, right? But I feel like the Cavs really just played a lot better. And then the Cavs defense has just been letting the Pacers back in the game.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's been as competitive as the final scores have looked. I mean, seems like Cleveland's really had their way with them for most of three quarters in both games. Pacers make a run early in the fourth, sort of get back into it. You see like all these different places where Indiana just doesn't measure up. Like obviously the late game execution is like the most obvious one. Pacers had a couple huge brain farts in game two that just kind of gave it away. But even in the middle of the game, you watch both games, and the Cavaliers can just hunt these mismatches. And, game one, it was getting switches on the pick and roll and having LeBron matched up on Teague, and then he's taking him down to the post, and he's either scoring on him down there or he's kicking it out when the defense collapses. And in game two, it was a little more of like Kyrie taking a big off the dribble or Kevin Love then getting matched up on a wing and, taking Lance Stephenson down in the post. And the Cavs are
that was brutal. That whole stretch. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
it was embarrassing. It was like a 12th grader playing with a 6th grader.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the Pacers are. I mean, they can only take one of those things away at a time, and so there's always like two other options for the Cavs, and the Cavs are good enough that they know how to hunt those mismatches out and make sure that they're exploiting them. I think that's sort of the big difference between these teams. The three-point shooting is sort of a pervasive thing. I think I maybe worry about it or fret about it more than some other Pacers fans do. But this idea that they're going to sort of play this up-tempo modern game, I feel like it doesn't work if there's not shooting. Ideally at every position, but certainly at four spots on the floor. And it feels like what the Pacers built was like an up-tempo team from the 90s or they're not an up-tempo pace and space team from this era. They're an up-tempo pace and space team from like a decade ago.
Let me ask you real quick then. A quick detour because, Larry Bird's been in the game for a while as a coach. He coached in the 90s and then he's been in the front office now for a while. But he played in the 80s. Could it be possible that maybe the game might have passed Larry Bird by? Or did he just not get the guys he wanted and the roster is just not complete?
No, I mean, it seemed like they got the guys they wanted. I mean, they pulled the trigger. They made that trade to get Jeff Teague. They thought that was going to be an upgrade. And I don't think, In terms of like talent in a void, Jeff Teague and George Hill, I think they're pretty comparable. I think the skills that Hill had were more useful to the Pacers. And so, for me, that was sort of a step back. I think Hill's spot up shooting, the fact that he didn't need the ball in his hands, and then the fact that he could defend multiple positions and really well, I think that was much more important than having, another above average, pick and roll creator, which was sort of the impetus for Teague. And same thing with Thad Young. They traded a first round pick to go out and get him, and his athletic ability, his speed in the open court, like all that stuff's great, but it's a problem in the half court. You know, he's limited in the places where he can play and, you know, not hurt the team. I mean, he's sort of got to be on the baseline. He's got to be a cutter, or he's got to be a pick and roll man. And all of those things, just when he's out there, it just kind of decreases the space on the floor. So you look at the Pacers, and their two best three-point shooters are probably Teague and George, and one of those guys probably has the ball in his hands, which means there's really only one sort of like outside shooting threat on the floor at any time. And that just, you know, it just tightens things up, and it's not catastrophic, you know. Clearly they were still good enough to make the playoffs, and, you know, if a couple other things had broken their way, you know, maybe they're even a higher seed. But I feel like it really sort of sets a ceiling on their offensive ability when, you know, they can't sort of run out lineups for even a few minutes a game where there's shooters, you know, everywhere.
You know what? I guess I see it differently. I was disappointed by them this year. I thought that, you know, initially I projected them to be maybe a 4 or 5 seed. But just on the strength of Paul George, and I definitely thought it was a downgrade to get Teague instead of George Hill. I understood the concept of what they wanted to do, but it just didn't make sense. You know, George Hill was so good when Paul George is out that you just run with it. You run with two guys like that with him and Paul George. I like CJ Miles. Monta's still getting a lot of minutes for some odd reason, and he shouldn't probably. So regardless, they've been a 500 team all year, and you know they win a couple, lose a couple. Win 3, lose 4. That's how they were all year, and it took Paul George being Herculean in March for them to actually, you know, close the kick. So, you know, and he's been fantastic this whole series. This series has been fantastic, and it's sad to see because he's such a great player, I think, and I think this team kind of, I think Bird kind of failed him.
Yeah, I mean that's... the roster is not ideal, and you know, the other thing that should probably be said is the Teague and Thad Young additions aren't nearly as bad if they also could have like unloaded Monte Ellis and Rodney Stuckey and got guys in those positions who were shooters, but because they were committed to those guys and those guys were locked in, you know, those are two more guys we sort of have to play who are only effective with the ball in their hands and can't space the floor. You know, if I don't know, can't think of guys off the top of my head, but if Rodney Stuckey and Monte Ellis were, I don't know, Nick Stauskas and Ben McLemore, like, you know, not necessarily significantly better players, but guys who could actually shoot and also sort of run the floor and keep up with the offense, they might have been in an infinitely better position. But the other thing is, too, I think that's not been talked about enough, and this, some of this is sort of my nitpicking with Paul George's game, is when this happens, like when the spacing gets tight, when their offense sort of gets disrupted, I feel like it often plays into like his worst offensive tendencies. The less space there is on the floor, the harder it is for him to get to the rim, and I think you saw that a lot this year, especially in the middle of the year when they were struggling, is he was just like far too willing to settle for mid-range jump shots. And yeah, it's understandable because there's not a lot of space on the floor, and you know, attacking the rim means, you know, a lot of wear and tear on his body and you know, taking big hits and not sort of those kinds of easy shots. And so, you know, sometimes a halfway contested 16-footer seems like the best option. But yeah, I feel like it just sort of, you know, brought out the kind of the worst in his offensive game playing with this group.
It makes me sad because we know he's up for free agency in 2018.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think sooner or later he's... I like the fact that he's there in Indiana, and he's like, you know, they love him there. The fans do, but, I mean, if he leaves, you kind of got to understand. And I'm just...
I certainly wouldn't blame him. I think, I don't know. I mean, I have a hard time sort of projecting the kinds of player movement, and, you know, is he really going to want to leave? You know, will the team really sort of be willing to bite the bullet and trade him? But it seems like it, you know, if they're going to flame out in this first round series and the way it's going, it seems like it's, you know, probably a good move to explore the trade market again this summer and see, you know, what's out there. And I'm of the mind that they're not going to get a fair deal for him. I mean, there's sort of no way for them to, you know, get 100 cents on the dollar in a trade for him. There's going to be some risk involved and taking some draft picks that, you know, may or may not pan out. And, you know, you might not land a player who's going to ever be as good as George is. But I also think the way this roster is built, the, you know, the age of Miles Turner, what's sort of around them, I don't think they're going to be a championship contender in Georgia's prime. And so, you know, maybe it's worth just swinging for the fences and seeing what happens.
I mean, you called it, man. And that's the thing, right? It's like they got stuck between adding all these kind of middling vets, these guys who are good role players. If you had two superstars, you know, they'd be fine, I think. And then they got Miles Turner, who's, you know, I think you can see from how he's played the playoffs, he's just really young. He's just green. He's just not ready yet. So, yeah, I really think Danny Ainge, he caught a lot of flack at the trade deadline, but I'm pretty sure his goal is this summer revisiting both Boston and Indiana with the hopes that now he's going to get a discount, you know.
Yeah, and it seems more likely he gets a discount from Indiana than he does from Chicago, especially if Chicago takes them out. That would be tough.
Yeah, especially with Butler being as awesome as he's been so far this series. Now, let me ask you this. Paul George has been in the news for his comments. You know, he's been a lot more vocal this year. He spoke out about the refs earlier this season, like December. He basically, you know, he got fined. He got a big fine, but he was just saying it's just not fair. So he said, I'm confident in all my guys taking shots. That's not the issue. This is after game one when he passed the ball to CJ. He thought he came running, I was going to get it back. CJ took the shot. It wasn't a bad shot. But in this situation, I gotta get that. Is that fair or foul? I love it. Again, no, we want the right play. Mm-hmm. But like, look at Russell Westbrook, and we do kill him. He overdoes it sometimes. But these guys, the responsibility is on their shoulders. You know, there's footage of him, of Paul George hitting that exact same shot off a feed from David West. Mm-hmm. You know, he can pull the long three. He's a big shot maker, big shot taker. I see what he's saying, but I mean, you would think him and CJ would have talked about that beforehand, and that's kind of where, that's the only thing I got a problem with. But is that fair or foul?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of weird to me because I wonder who he's directing that comment at. I mean, for me, from the outside perspective, it seems like the problem there was McMillan, that they sort of set up a play, they watched it get doubled, they took the foul, because there was still a foul to give, and then they ran the exact same play. And there was no... there was no counter. There was no complexity. There was no alternative. You know, they just sort of went out there and did the same thing. And so, you know, having that double come to George, they should have been expecting it. So I don't know if that's, I don't know. Like, when I listen to that, I wonder if that was directed more at McMillan than it was to CJ Miles. But I don't know. I also have this thing about Paul George, and I feel like it's come to a head in the past couple weeks. Like, he just, I don't know, maybe this is overblown, but for me, it's something that I sort of focus in on. He just, like, he doesn't seem like a fun guy to play with. He doesn't ever seem like he's enjoying himself. Like, he gets hyped, he gets, you know, aggressive, he gets excited, he does his, you know, his ferocious shouts after a big dunk or whatever, but, like, I don't know. You watch some guys who are leaders or stars on their team, and they seem to be, like, having fun, and he doesn't ever look like he's having fun to me. And then I watch the Pacers, and they never look like they're having fun, and they don't look like they really enjoy playing together either. And so I wonder if some of that sort of goes back to George's personality. Like, he's the leader of this team. He is sort of, by virtue of his talent, also kind of like the biggest personality. And if he's, you know, not really having fun and not really enjoying himself, how much does that sort of, like, bleed out to the rest of the guys? And so I wonder, you know, if Isaiah Thomas says something like, I'm confident in all my guys taking shots, that's not the issue, I've got to get the ball in a situation like that. I feel like that comment comes off differently and is heard differently by his teammates, because Isaiah has a different relationship with his teammates than George does. And again, that's from a total outsider, but...
I'll say this. I agree with you about him seeming kind of joyless this year. I didn't feel that from him last year. I didn't get that vibe last year. I think a lot of it is he's just unhappy with the team.
Yeah.
The way the direction of the team went, right? The whole, I mean, from the get-go, you're going to play power forward. No, I'm not. Yeah, you are. And his GM, you know, Bird was being a jerk about it. And people liked it. I didn't like it. I'm like, dude, that's your multi-million dollar star player. You go to him and talk to him. You don't just demand it in the media. That doesn't make any sense. And then, you know, they weren't very good. You know, I noticed this about him too, and tell me if I'm wrong. Early in the season, he always goes off, and then he'll tail off in January and February. And I think part of it's fatigue. He comes out the gates a little too, you know, run a little hot. And I feel like this season he purposely throttled back early and then kicked it in late in March. And so it looked, you know, he wasn't carrying them like, you know, I saw people saying his win shares and all this were a lot lower than Jimmy Butler's. Well, yeah, he wasn't. I didn't see him putting in that kind of usage. He just wasn't. He wasn't trying to dominate the ball. And they lost. They're a 500 team. So yeah, he didn't seem very happy. I did say he seemed very disconnected for most of the season, and that's just it's troubling for the Pacers and their fans, man.
Yeah, I don't know where you go from here. I don't think there's any good options. I don't think there's any good, easy answers. I think whatever happens, if they trade him, they're gonna get killed in the local media. No matter what the deal is, if they keep him and continue losing, they're gonna get killed in the same way. You know, especially if he leaves. So. Yeah, it's one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't, I think. And it's unfortunate because they seemed like they were really sort of building something productive. And, you know, even Turner last year was sort of so, inspiring. He was supposed to be so much of a project. And, you know, he came right out of the gates that was 3-4 games or whatever in the Orlando Summer League where he was, you know, drop step and dunk and hitting these fadeaway, jumpers over everybody. And it was like, oh man, like, you know, he might be a player like right now. We might not have to wait 2 or 3 years on him. And then, you know, to watch the team sort of tread water this year, even after all those big summer additions, it was definitely discouraging.
You feel that Miles Turner might have kind of stagnated this year?
I think he got better in some ways. I think things that are maybe hard to see. I would guess that his physical stuff really progressed this year. I think he played a lot more minutes. He looked a lot less winded. He sort of he was able to sort of maintain intensity for a longer period of time. And I think defensively he was really good this year.
He was, yeah.
I think they, and maybe really good is an exaggeration, but he certainly progressed a lot defensively. I think there's still a long way to go on that end. Just sort of figuring out where he's supposed to be, how he's supposed to, how he's supposed to rotate, how he's supposed to sort of be the backbone of that defense. And offensively, I think he just, they're not asking him to do a lot other than pick and pop right now. And so it was nice to see him stretch his range out to the 3-point line a little bit. I think he hit, something like 34%. But the volume was still pretty low. You know, they're not using him out behind the 3-point line a ton. He's not out there like Marc Gasol or Brooke Lopez or something like that. So, I think it was a good season. It was a good step forward. I think people forget how young he is. And he's in that weird position where, because he got drafted the same year as Kristaps and Towns, he's always either going to be like completely overshadowed by them or he's going to be compared to them. And it's sort of like a lose-lose either way. Nobody's going to pay attention to him, or if they do pay attention to him, they're going to be, pointing out how he's not those other two guys.
Yeah, I've seen a couple articles where he's been included as far as, they say Jokic, and they say Kristaps, they say Cat, and they'll throw Miles Turner in there. I know he's not up there really on their level, but he's really good, and he's going to be a good pro for a long time. Do you think McMillan is the right hire? Is he the right coach for this team?
No. It seemed like valuing continuity and the fact that he was already on the bench, he was already an assistant, but... I'll freely admit that I'm sure there's a ton of strategic and front office stuff that I don't understand at all. But like from an outsider, you say you want to play pace and space and you hire a guy who has an extensive coaching experience and all of his teams play an extremely slow half court sort of grinded out game. And some of those teams were really good and, clearly he's had other coaching experiences and other playing experiences beyond that. But it seems like, it just seemed like a really sort of unimaginative, not creative, not thinking outside the box at all. It was like grabbing the nearest guy who sort of, fit the criteria, the nearest guy who was qualified. And I guess probably that's my biggest frustration with the Pacers overall, like the past 3 years is like, it feels like a lack of imagination. I don't know. It doesn't feel like they're sort of setting like the loftiest goals for themselves. They're determined to like make these kind of like incremental steps instead of, you know, sort of shooting big. Like I have this other thing where I feel like power forward, that position, I feel like that really defines your team. That defines your identity. The players, it's become such a sort of like important swing position that sort of mm-hmm. defines your style. If you have a guy who can shoot threes, that allows you to play a certain way. You have a guy who can shoot threes and he can make a pass, you know, as the roll man, he can catch the ball on the short roll and hit the guy in the corner. That opens up a certain, you know, level of things. You've got a three who can sort of just run the floor and block shots and rebound, like that sort of, you know, lets you play a certain way. And so I feel like if the Pacers wanted to play a certain way, then they needed to get the power forward that fit that identity, especially because, you know, their power forward position has been pretty much David West, you know, up until the past 2 years. And so I felt like giving up that 17th or the 21st pick or whatever it was to take Thad Young on seemed like, yeah, just sort of like the least creative move. Like, you know, maybe there wasn't a game changer there, but I don't know. Somebody like Juan Hernan Gomez, who went to Denver, who, you know, looks like this possibly is really versatile defender, could defend multiple positions, can run the floor, maybe even a 3-point shooter. I don't know.
It'd be good, man.
It just seemed like there were some other possibilities there. Like, it seemed like a place to take a swing, and they were just like, well, we're gonna get a good player, and it you know, didn't matter so much who the player was or why they were good. It was just, you know, we got to get a good player with this pick. So,
and a good player with a name. He wanted a name. Thad Young, and Thad Young has a reputation, you know, as a good pro. It's just, yeah.
And I've got nothing against Thad Young. He's a nice guy. He plays hard. He's certainly like played up to his ability with the Pacers, and you know, it's been fun watching him when he's having good games and stuff. It's more about the team sort of, you know, putting him in that position to not be something different, I guess.
So do they take a game from Cleveland?
I think they probably take one. I'm guessing there's a game where, I don't know, Cleveland's intensity wanes a little bit, a couple things break the Pacers' way, and George, you know, has another ridiculous game. He's played incredible, but, you know, we haven't had like a 40-point explosion from Paul George, and I'm guessing we get one of those when we're in Indiana, and yeah, they probably take one game, but not much more than that, I would expect.
Let's say they don't they take one, but then they end up taking another one. Who would be the X factor on the Pacers roster to make that happen? Somebody besides Paul George, who would have to really kind of go nuts and make things happen for them to take two and tie it up 2-2?
I guess Miles Turner. I don't know. Think about everybody else sort of playing to the best of their ability. You know, Teague and Thad Young played really well in game two. You know, I think they sort of, you know, had good games for what they're capable of doing. And, you know, if Turner has a game where he really gets hot from the outside, he's drilling jump shots, it opens the defense up a little bit. And it seems like, you know, I don't think he's the guy to sort of solve the Pacers' defensive issues, but you could see a game where he, you know, gets a couple blocks, makes a couple sharp rotations, and all of a sudden, you know, Cleveland's just thinking for an extra half second, and you know, some of those mismatches that they're trying to take advantage of, him floating around on the back line is able to, you know, sort of mitigate them a little bit. So, you know, I mean, I guess that's been the thing the whole season. You know, Turner is you know, what could potentially elevate them to the next level.
My friends was like, you know, what's up, Truth? And I was like, you know, that got a kind of good ring to it.
Yeah, maybe next year. Let's hope they, I don't know, so they finagle some kind of deal this summer and get in more help, and they or maybe they come back just a little more cohesive next year.
Yeah.
So I say Cavs in five.
Yeah, that's my guess too.
Let's swing over to the West. You also did a nice little look at the Rockets and Thunder. Thunder got embarrassed game one. They got skull dragged by almost 30. Russ didn't look very good. If the MVP votes came after that first game, you know, it'd be hard in the landslide, and Russ probably wouldn't be top five. He looked really bad. You actually had a theory, and you made, again, you opened my eyes to a lot of stuff. So, 15 turnovers for OKC, and they had 7 of those 15, you know, right after a defensive rebound. I think Russ had 3 within 10 or 12 seconds of getting the defensive rebound. Roberson got a rebound. They had a turnover, you know, within 3 or 4 seconds of that, or 10 seconds after that. And then, you know, so a total of 7 of their turnovers were after a defensive rebound. And, you know, the Thunder's half-court offense is a dumpster fire. But, you know, your theory is, like, maybe they got to run a little more judiciously. But, like we just said, their half-court offense is a mess, and the only way they can really generate offense is second-chance points and pretty much pick up the pace. But, I mean, Houston seems fine running at that same kind of pace. What, you know, the Thunder ran Houston off the three-point line, which is awesome, and they kind of matched them with, you know, they didn't the three-point differential, I think, was maybe 1. OKC might even have more. But, you know, because of the switching up top, and Steven Adams and Taj Gibson and Enes Kanter ended up guarding somebody at the top of the key, and the shot goes up, or they get taken to the hole, and guess what? Nene and Clint Capela are just beasting against the small fours and the two guards that they got out there. And so they just crushed OKC on the second chance points. They had a 27-point advantage in second chance points. What can OKC realistically do to kind of mitigate first of all, we know OKC is one of the best rebounding teams in the league, right? So they got to just rebound better. What else do you see that OKC can maybe tweak? What can Donovan tweak to give his team a better chance in game two?
Yeah, they looked a little unprepared in terms of scheme. Some of the switching stuff you were talking about, how they pulled their rebounders out of position. And my thing with the transition game, that might have been a case of overly dramatic headlining. But my argument wasn't that they need to stop running, because they obviously need to run. Like, their half court offense is not great. It's the more possessions that they can get out and score early, the better off they are. But I think we're at a place where, you know, any team in the NBA can run and score efficiently off live ball turnovers. You know, that's a situation that's just sort of a given. And I feel like what separates the real sort of up-tempo offenses is the teams that run off made baskets, or run off, you know, defensive rebounds, even deep ones. And so I just was sifting through a couple numbers from that game, and it was something like, I think it was 10 points per 100 possessions fewer the Thunder averaged on their possessions after defensive rebounds in game one compared to their season average. And it seemed like a huge difference. And I started digging into the turnover numbers, and you could just see how many turnovers there were that came with them trying to push off defensive rebounds. And so it seemed like the Rockets' defense was prepared. They did a really nice job of getting back. And the Thunder just looked, they just looked amped. They just, you know, just sort of playing with like a nervous energy, just sort of pushing, pressing, playing a little out of control. So my idea about, you know, slowing things down was not like, don't push off defensive rebounds. It was like, just like take a deep breath, and, you know, maybe it's a half second slower in transition, but just, playing a little more calmly, and, you know, being willing to pull things back a little bit if there's not an immediate opportunity. Not necessarily, you know, stop trying to get the ball up as quickly as possible, but just a little more self control there. They just seem, you know, sort of wild in their pushes.
I consider myself one of the premier Russ enthusiasts out there, right? I'm kind of an aficionado of Russell Westbrook play. I've watched almost every game he's played this year, and everything you say is spot on. I've noticed some games he comes out, and you can see he's almost like too revved up, right? He has his spots. He likes to get this little, what he calls a cotton shot, you know, free throw line extended, whatever. He likes to get in the post and hit him with a little turnaround, or, you know, a couple dribbles and a hard turnaround. He'll, he has his moves. Well, this game I noticed he was scattered all over the place. He was just kind of doing anything, you know. You don't normally see that. And it's funny because I think all season he torched the Houston Rockets. He averaged like 36-9. You know, 36 points a game. He shot like 46% on the season against Houston. So it's not like Patrick Beverley kills him or gives him trouble, but he let Patrick Beverley give him trouble. Yeah, he was and as he goes, that team goes, right? So if he gets out of sorts, you can tell the rest of the team is like dominoes. They just kind of fall apart with him. So yeah, that's a good call, man. I felt the same. They just did not look like the lights were too bright, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if it was necessary. I mean, I guess pressure, but I mean, there's I don't know, the ability to just sort of like step back, take a deep breath, and, you know, I don't know, just not, I guess, yeah, I guess you're right, not let the moment get the better of them. They just, you know, they clearly they have a lot to prove. Westbrook especially feels like, you know, this is him versus Harden. This is, you know, whatever the MVP race encapsulates, and you know, just it seemed like he was trying to live that out a little bit too much. So I think the series will certainly be a lot closer than game one. Some of that bad offensive rebounding by the Thunder, I don't think that's going to persist. Some of that was, you know, was just some fluky stuff. So a lot of the stuff that went wrong for them, I think, will sort of self-correct on its own. But they're, you know, they dug themselves a hole with that bad first game.
Yeah, yeah, and that team, I've noticed that sometimes they kind of flow, and like the when they beat the Raptors, they beat the heck out of the Raptors, and they all just play really well together. And sometimes they look like they just met for the first time 10 minutes before the game started, and like they just can't get anything going. So I got Rockets in that series. You know, I'm hoping six, and the Russ fan of me wants to say seven, but I'm hoping at least five or six. Well, what do you think? How does this one turn out?
I'm guessing six for the Rockets. Yeah, I think it's, you know, pretty close from here on out. I think the Rockets are clearly the better team. I think they, you know, they just sort of go deeper. They have more options, more ways they can beat the Thunder. But, yeah, I think, you know, I think Westbrook's going to bounce back and have some huge moments.
I hope so, man. So same question I have about the Indiana Cavs series. Let's say if OKC wanted to tie this up or, you know, even take the lead and make it the real series, who has to really step up for them?
I'm going to say Roberson. You know, he had a really nice game one. He needs to be a defensive presence. He needs to be disruptive. But he's also a guy who I feel like can slip through the cracks a little bit offensively. You know, the Rockets aren't going to really defend him out at the 3-point line. There's room for him to, you know, to hit some open shots, to slip through, you know, find some open space on cuts, to maybe crash the offensive glass a little bit, you know, if Adams or Cantor or Sabonis or whatever pulled out to the 3-point line, you know, defending Ryan Anderson. You know, there's room for Roberson to really have an impact.
He was awesome last game. He was actually hitting his threes. The only issue I really have is that they switch a little too easily up top. You know, if Roberson, we know he's the guy to guard. You know, they try to mirror his minutes with Harden. If he's the guy, he got to fight a little harder through those screens. And the guys behind him and whoever, you know, is getting screened, him and his big man up there running that pick and roll defense, whoever's behind him, we have to be really cognizant, because it was way too easy last game. And tell me if I'm crazy with this. I would like to see a lineup of Taj Gibson, Jeremy Grant, Roberson, and then Depot and Russ. And I mean, Clint Capella not post anybody up. Nene can, but that's just not the offense they run. So they don't really need to have the two big guys, Cantor Adams, out there. And that gives them, that's a little better switchability. I trust Jeremy Grant out on the perimeter, and Taj can contain a little better on the perimeter, more than I trust, you know, Steven Adams and Enes, the dancing man Cantor, because, yeah, Harden had him on skates. So, I mean, is that a lineup for him to try? You think Adams can run that out?
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I don't think Cantor is going to be huge in this series. You know, a lot of his value is, you know, holding up the second unit offense and you know, really killing second unit centers in the post. But he's not going to do that against Capella or Nene. So I think a lot of his offensive value is mitigated. And obviously, you know, want to get him off the floor on defense as much as possible. So, yeah.
Did you see the clip of Donovan literally saying it? He sits back after watching him get abused, and he goes, he looks over at his assistant coach and goes, "We can't play Cantor." You see that clip?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's crazy. I mean, you know what? And it's even when he has the ball and, you know, he's facing up and he's sizing up his offense and starts making his move, you can see the defenders on the other side of the lanes. They start stunting and cheating in because they don't have to worry about the shooters. And that's, I mean, OKC, it's funny. I'm seeing people saying, oh, Russ is getting exposed and they lose. I'm like, if he wins MVP and they lose, what a fraud. I said, this is the 6 seed versus the 3 seed. You know, Houston was one of the, I think they had like the 9th best offense of all time.
Yeah.
You know, what do you guys, what's exposed? He's losing to a better team. So, yeah, we both agree, 5 or 6 games, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll go a lot quicker through the rest of them. Just, I want to touch on everybody else. And then we'll get to some Twitter questions. I was nice enough to, my followers are nice enough to send us a nice little bevy of questions. So let's go Wiz Hawks. I got the Wizards in this series, especially after I saw Markieff Morris. The fact that he had Millsap kind of whining about physicality after one game, that's kind of troubling for me if I'm a Hawks fan.
Yeah.
And my question to you, all right, so we know John Wall is the man in Washington. Millsap's the best player in Atlanta. Outside of those two, who are the guys who are like the most important players if each team wants to win?
Washington needs Beal and Porter to hit shots, Porter to play some defense. Markieff Morris and Gortat have to do their jobs. Atlanta really needs offense from somebody else. I think Schroeder's kind of a losing battle against Wall, and asking him to kind of step up and do more is maybe putting their resources in the wrong place. So, they need Bazemore and Hardaway to really hit shots and kind of stretch Washington's defense if they're going to have any shot.
Yeah, that about, I mean, I don't think Atlanta's going to, they was just a weird team all year. So gut feeling, real quick, is Paul Millsap with them next year?
Man, I don't know. I would have said no for sure, but then they went and kept him and, held on him at the deadline, and, he seemed fine with that. They, went on that run. I don't know. I have a hard time with projecting that stuff. I guess my gut reaction would be no, but, yeah, I don't know. I guess it wouldn't shock me either.
You know what's weird? When he was at Utah, I remember when he signed with Atlanta, he took like a bargain basement deal, even though he could have got more money elsewhere, and then I think he had a max offer in Orlando, and he went back to Atlanta. He's a weird guy, not a weird guy in a bad way. He just seems like he marches to the beat of his own drums. I wouldn't be surprised to see him back either. Bucks Wraps. Since Middleton returned on February 8th, Milwaukee went 20-12, which is the third most wins over that span since, from February 8th to the end of the season. And Toronto went 19-10. So I think it's safe to say that when Middleton, he came in, and even though it's true, Toronto missed Kyle Lowry for a good handful of games. But, I mean, it's the 3-6 matchup, but it's a lot closer than most 3-6s. Let's say Toronto, they lost tonight, 106-100, so they played them tight, but they got the split already, right? They got the split already on Toronto's home floor. Let's say the Raptors, the Bucks pull this off and they end up beating Toronto in this series. That's, of course, a big deal for Toronto, but how big of an upset do you really consider that?
I still think it's a pretty big upset. I guess you could slice it a couple ways. I think it would be a huge upset in sort of the narrative sense. Bucks are still this up-and-coming team. They're missing Jabari Parker, who's, on paper one of their most important players. The Raptors, went all in at the trade deadline and added Ibaka and PJ Tucker. So I think in that context, it would look pretty bad. I do think it's sort of hard to judge Toronto because they got Ibaka and Tucker at the same time that they lost Lowry. And so, on paper, their team is much better than Milwaukee and is probably better than Boston or Washington. And, on paper, they sort of look like the real team that should be challenging Cleveland. But we don't know because they haven't had Lowry and Tucker and Ibaka for the same, on the floor for very long. And so they're sort of going through this process, that they maybe, should have been going through at the beginning of the year, and they're working on it now. So I think their ceiling is probably higher than anybody in the East other than Cleveland, but it remains to be seen if they actually get there. They've got to sort of work out these lineups. They've got to work out, rhythm and spots on the floor and how everybody's going to sort of work together. So I think it would be if you take into account that they're sort of jumbled, that they're in this place where their most important players haven't all been on the same team for very long, and they're still sort of figuring out how to work together. I guess it's not a huge surprise that Milwaukee could sneak in and beat them, take a couple games, or maybe even win the series. But yeah, I think on paper, and I think the public reaction to it would be enormous, and maybe be the end of this Toronto era. They'd really have to start breaking stuff up.
That was going to be my next question to you. Is like, let's say they come up short, and even if they beat, like they should beat, if they beat the Raptors, that's not a big surprise. But they're going to say they lose in the second round. Kyle Lowry's up for one of those mega deals this year, right? I think somewhere between 150 and 200 mil. Is that worth it? and Ibaka's he's up for a big deal too. He's going to command good money. Yeah, they already got 145 wrapped up in DeMar DeRozan. Is that really worth it to invest in all three of those guys? Do you think that's worth it for Toronto for where they are? I know it's hard to get real good talent up there. Do they do like the Memphis Grizzlies and say, all right, well, we might not be contenders, but we're a good team and we're going to be good every year, and that's worth something to the city of Toronto? Or do they say, you know what, let's try to get some kind of contending status here and really do it, and it's time for us to move on from these guys?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like they're in a different place than Memphis or even the Pacers, like we were talking about earlier. Like, Toronto's much closer to being a contender than Memphis or the Pacers have been, or I guess before than the Pacers have been the past few years, and maybe better than Memphis has ever been. And I guess the question is, like, I don't know how they get closer than they are now. You know, like, we were talking about the Pacers earlier. Like, I don't see how they're a contender in the next 3-4 years with Paul George. But they could sort of tear it down and start from scratch and sort of, you know, rebuild something. But I don't know how the Raptors get closer than they are now. To me, Kyle Lowry's maybe a top 10 player in the NBA. They have this roster that works, that's really deep. There's been stretches where they've played, you know, elite defense. There's been stretches where they've played elite offense. I mean, the first, I don't know what it was, six, 8 weeks into the season, their offense was better than the Warriors and was on track to be the most efficient offense of all time relative to the league average. And it faded a little bit. But, I mean, the idea of tearing it down, I mean, I guess there's maybe that sense where it's like, you've got to react, you know, it hasn't worked, we have to try something new. But I don't know what else they would do that gets closer. I mean, even if you think about them, you know, sort of rebuilding in a couple years and sort of having a different roster, you would be building towards this same kind of ideal. You'd be building towards a team that, like, had a star player like Kyle Lowry who excelled at both ends and had a really deep, flexible, versatile roster around them. You know, you'd be building towards the same kind of, like, hypothetical team. So it seems like to me, even if it doesn't work this year, you know, I guess supposing, unless it happens like in a really ugly way, but if they get eliminated from the playoffs, I think you bring Lowry back, you try and sign Ibaka, and you run it back, and you hope you get lucky, and you hope it works the next time, and you stay healthy, and maybe somebody else doesn't, and you catch a break here or there, and then that's enough to finally break through.
Well, my guy Kevin O'Connor on the Ringer pod, shout out to Kevin. I know you probably won't listen to this, but I'm going to do it anyway. He actually brought that. He kind of raised that point of, he goes, go into the summer, do everything you're going to do, and say, hey, we're going to go for contending, but if it's not, you know, you take a look at it by the All-Star break, and you take a look at it, you know, I guess by the next summer, and hey, then you make some decisions but I get it, though. I get it. It's so easy for us to sit here and say, oh, just tear it down. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a multi-billion dollar franchise, and, you know, they're a winning team. They're not bad. Mm-hmm. They're just playing in the age of LeBron. It's not, you know, it's not their fault. And, you know, now Giannis is coming. The age of Giannis is going to follow the age of LeBron. The East might be locked down for a while, but there's nothing wrong with, you know, making a very good team, and then all you just hope for the things to fall your way. So mm-hmm. I'm with you. They just keep it together, man. There's nothing much you can do. Bulls, Celtics. Celtics stink on the boards. The Bulls are just basically, you know, just they put a shot up and there's 2 or 3 guys going to the glass. Robin Lopez is just having his way. It is what it is, man. How on a scale of Isaiah Thomas to Magic Johnson, so small to big, a scale of Isaiah Thomas to Kevin Durant, what chance do you give Chicago of upsetting the Boston Celtics?
I would say it's looking more and more likely. Honestly, I'm shocked. I mean, there's the thing, right? The Celtics are not sort of a typical number one seed. They have, I don't know, I can't remember all the numbers. Somebody said in a post I edited today, but, you know, their record is really weak for a number one seed. Even their point differential is really weak for a number one seed. It's not what you typically see from the top team in either conference. And I don't know what it was, like, their point differential ranks like 5th or 6th this year among all teams. There's other teams in the East that have a better point.
We know, Ian. We know. We have to rub it in. Okay, yeah, we get it. Basically, you're saying as far as number one seeds, there's a lot to be desired. Okay.
Yeah. But the Bulls are a freaking disaster. Like, it's, you know, it would make more sense to me if the Celtics were matched up with the Pacers and found themselves in this position with the Pacers. Maybe not strategically, maybe not looking at the specific players, but, yeah, I don't know. The Bulls have felt like such a chaotic mess this year that it's, you know, I don't trust Chicago with anything. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess we're getting closer to sort of like 50-50 toss-up area, but I think I would still probably bet on the Celtics and feel safer than I would betting on the Bulls.
And we're not going to talk too much about the Dubs in Portland. I would love to see Nurkic healthy. I think it still would have been, you know, Golden State goes away and basically a laugher. But it would have made it a lot more interesting. Let's talk about, I'm going to look for next year. What one player that would, one, ideally, you could add to Portland to make them just like, a top four seed. And then realistically, what moves do you think they can make this summer? I'm gonna actually go first this time. Ideally, he just came to me. I don't know how they would do it. You know, they have a lot of movable but kind of average talent. If they could find a way to get Paul George to go with CJ and Dame and Nurk, I don't care what else you have out there. That'd be an awesome team. And then that's ideally. Realistically, I was thinking, and tell me if I'm crazy. I talked to a couple of Portland guys about this. They somehow move CJ McCollum for Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, and now you got a defender in the backcourt and a guy who can, you know, be a supplementary scorer to Dame, and you still got Nurk down there, and, you know, Chief is doing his thing. I like that one.
Yeah, I like that too, and especially, I guess I don't know how the perception of McCollum and Caldwell-Pope is in the front office land as opposed to, you know, on basketball Twitter, but I would guess that most fans would consider McCollum head and shoulders above Caldwell Pope. I'm not sure it's that big a difference, but you know, Portland might be able to get some other sort of, you know, asset in that deal. Maybe it's Stanley Johnson or Henry Ellenson or something like that, you know, somebody else useful in that deal. But yeah, I like that a lot. Maybe call me crazy, but I think Noah Vonleh might be the piece they're missing. They've got, you know, I know he struggled, but and he struggled in game one, but they've got all of these pieces, like in the front court positions, everybody between Nurkic and McCollum, small forward and power forward, and everybody's got like a piece of the puzzle. But they don't have anybody who can sort of do everything. You know, they've got like Al-Farouq Aminu can sort of defend both of those positions. He can switch, he can cover a lot of ground, but his shooting's awful. You know, they've got Harkless, same kind of thing, like good defender, shooting kind of goes in and out. Evan Turner, I don't know what you even want to call him. You know, Alan Crabb, you know, can do a little of these things, and then he kind of disappears night to night. You know, Myers Leonard, athletic, can maybe shoot threes, can be a, you know, an absolute train wreck on defense. And Vonleh seems like a guy who's maybe sort of, you know, putting it together in some small ways where, you know, he could be a shooter, he could be an athletic defender. But I think, you know, circling back to my power forward fantasy, I think that's what the Trailblazers need. I think they need somebody at the four. If they're going to go with Nurkic, they really need somebody at the four who can shoot. But ideally, somebody who can pass, move the ball a little bit, and maybe defend a couple positions. And the nice thing about
Paul Millsap?
Millsap would work. Millsap would be really nice. The nice thing about Nurkic, I think, in the middle is they could even go a little bit smaller there at the four. Like, it doesn't have to be sort of a traditional power forward. You know, they could get somebody who's going to be a sort of a, I don't know, whatever, I'm doing air quotes here, a small ball four who can sort of play starter minutes there. And I think they'd, you know, they'd be able to survive with Nurkic in the middle. But yeah, I think that's the position for them. I'm trying to think. Maybe like a Trevor Ariza, not that he's somebody who would be available, but I don't know. Otto Porter, if Otto Porter was available, he'd be really nice. I think they could slot him maybe and have him play a lot of four.
You know, he's about to get a max deal too. He's about to get
paid. Yeah.
How many, do you think Portland steals a game?
Yeah, I think there's probably at least one game. You know, when it comes to these series, like if you have a guy who can, you know, just sort of go off and drop 40, you know, there's a good chance of stealing a game. And Portland's got two of those guys. So, yeah, I think they probably get one, but that's about it.
Do you think that Dame and CJ are sustainable long term? Or I follow, there's been a growing sentiment that you got to split them up and, you know, and get somebody like a little more like KCP to run beside Dame and let CJ do his own thing. I don't know, man. CJ showed some pretty good defensive chops the other night against Clay. He did a good job. So if you can get him to lock in like that and still score the way he does, they got no problems.
Yeah, I'm of the opinion, I feel like I've been around long enough that I've come to the realization that anybody is workable. Like, you talk about any two-man pair, like, any two-man pair is workable. It depends on what the other three pieces are and what the rest of the bench is. So, yeah, I think McCollum and Lillard could work as a, you know, championship-level backcourt, provided that the rest of the roster, like, really accommodates that. I mean, I always circle back to this thing, like, Dirk Nowitzki, like, nobody thought Dirk Nowitzki was, you know, could be the centerpiece of a championship contender until he actually was the centerpiece of a championship contender. And, you know, so I feel the same way, you know, Lillard and McCollum, like they have these really obvious holes. You get a couple other guys who plug those holes around them and yeah, they could be a championship contender. I think the question is what's easier or what's more plausible? Like, is it more plausible that they find three guys around them that make them a championship contender? Or is it more plausible that they, you know, trade McCollum and sort of go in a more conventional route? You know, which one of those hypothetical championship rosters is easier to build? Unfortunately, I don't know the answer, but I don't ascribe to the idea that like you have two exceptional players who have some overlapping skills. Can they never work together?
Right, I mean, talent kind of wins out. Usually, we see talented teams flame out, but with two guys like that who both seem like they're working hard and they don't have any kind of other agendas, I think talent would win out. You can make it work. And I'm gonna come back to that at the end. We're gonna do some Twitter questions, but I'm gonna come back to some numbers that I think you'll like to hear. Thank you to everyone who sent questions in. I don't think we'll get to all of them because I've already kept my man Ian probably a little longer than he probably wanted to stay, but I appreciate you staying on so long, man. I appreciate
it. No worries.
So yeah, we'll just touch on a few of them. My man Ty Windish,
yeah,
he does timeout with Ti, timeout with Ty. I always say Ti, he gets mad because like it's Ty. You probably know who that is. He just wants to know which player and then which team has impressed you the most in the playoffs thus far.
Milwaukee has been pretty impressive. They, you know, I didn't think they would play Toronto as close as they've played them. And, you know, Greg Monroe has been fantastic for them. Giannis has been terrific. I guess they've sort of been the biggest shock, you know, winning game one and then really playing Toronto tough tonight. I thought that would be a close series, but I didn't think it'd be so. I didn't think it'd feel necessarily as close as it's been. And I will admit that I'm maybe pandering to Ty a little bit because he's a Bucks guy.
I got to go with Pat Beverly's first game. He was huge against the Thunder. And the same thing will go with the Rockets, man. The fact they dominated the best rebounding team in the league on the boards, and the fact that, you know, even though Harden didn't shoot well from three, he ended up with 37 freaking points, you know, and the two big men, Capella and Nene outplayed Adams and Cantor by a good bit. So Houston was the most impressive team, and Pat Bev had a great game, man. You can't take nothing from him, right?
Yeah, he was terrific.
My guy, Amar, at all that Amar, he wants to know, fix the Knicks. He said, you can't trade anybody. Just change the offensive X's and O's. What system do you use to win? Flex, motion, not triangle. I'll go first on this one, and I'll say that this is a trick question because I don't think the personnel matches. We know that Noah's not going to be healthy, and he's suspended, and Rose is not very good, and so if they bring him back, I think there's no way you can fix what they have right now. They got to make some moves, and I would have been more comfortable answering this last year before they traded away Robin Lopez and Jerian Grant and for whatever reason. So I'm going to say it's a trick question, and I don't think you really fix this. But if I was going to say one thing, I mean, if you got Derrick Rose, you run high pick and roll. You just keep running high pick and roll. And you got to get it's almost criminal how they kind of underused Kristaps this year. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think the problem here is in the front office. I don't think it's – I mean, the roster obviously is a bad fit, but I don't think that's the problem of the players. I think everybody kind of – there's nobody on this roster who's like an unknown quantity. Everybody knew who every one of these guys was coming into the season, and the guy who put them together, I think that's where you start fixing the Knicks. You can talk about triangle and strategy, but I don't know. Awareness, how you treat people, organizational values. I think there's a lot to work on in New York besides just what style offense they play.
Another question real quick. Let me ask you this. And my man Jesse Blanchard over B-Ball Breakdown asked me this. This is a quick aside. In 5 years, what team will be in a better position? The Nets or the Knicks?
Oh, the Nets. The Nets. I don't have any doubt. Sorry.
Suck it, Jesse. Suck it.
Yeah, I mean, you think about organizational values. You think about the structure that wraps around the players. I mean, the players come and go. People get hurt. People get traded. Even coaches come and go. But it's sort of like the mindset of an organization and who's holding those values. Whatever the Spurs are sort of like this golden child that's held up as the perfect thing for the league. But you see that in a lot of different places. You see it in Boston, even before Brad Stevens, they had an idea of what they wanted to do. And it's sort of held from the top down. And, there's several organizations like that. And you look at the Knicks, and it's the problems that they have are not just on the court. It seems like they struggle in every area of sort of being a functional professional sports franchise. And the Nets, obviously are in a tough position because of their draft pick situation. But I think they've got some nice young players, and I trust them. I trust the group that's there to sort of solve their on-court issues more than I trust the guys running the Knicks.
That was my exact answer, and my whole point was you can see what the Nets are doing. They're building a culture, and I mean, these guys play hard. They play together. They literally, this year with maybe a quarter of the talent, they played just as hard, and they were probably a scarier team to play than the Knicks. And I said in 5 years, and the answer I kept getting was, oh, well, they already have Kristaps. They have a path, and the Nets will have a path of talent. I said, and as we're seeing, they can very easily lose Kristaps. And we can give an 8-year-old a Porsche, and you can give a responsible adult a 2014 Camry. In 5 years, I bet that Camry would be better shape than that Porsche, because the 8-year-old doesn't know how to take care of a Porsche.
Yeah. Look at the Sacramento Kings. Like, they had DeMarcus Cousins, who's like one of the best big men in the league. They had him for years, and nothing ever came of it because everything that went around it was a disaster. So, yeah, saying Kristaps, means the Knicks are going to, are definitely headed in the right direction is a fallacy.
That's very much a fallacy, man. I knew I wasn't stupid, even though I might sometimes act stupid. Let's go back to a couple more questions. Thanks, Omar. I appreciate that. And I should go back to... let's see. Our guy, Justin Quinn, at Justin Quinn, wants to know, better path of contention for Boston in new CBA era, draft, trade, free agency, or a hybrid? I'm going to say it's got to be a hybrid because that's what they're doing. They got draft picks. They got plenty of assets and flexibility to make trades. I think they still have cap space for at least near max, right? Am I right? I think at least near for the near future. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing with Boston right now. There's no – people want to pin it on a certain roadmap. There's no roadmap. They have a lot of flexibility going forward, and that's why I'm not too stressed. I mean, really not that stressed about this series. In short term, I am. But in the long term, we know we're not beating the Cavs in the end of it. So what's the real stress? But yeah, Boston has a lot of different options in front of it, and they're gonna every step of the way after the draft when they get the kid, have at the trade deadline, we have so many options. So there's no real Ainge is gonna try to find the best way forward.
Yeah, and I think they're in this position where, they have a crack at maybe two number one picks. And the transformational talent that they could land this year and possibly next year too. Everybody's talking about what a stacked draft this is, and I also hear that like next year's draft could even potentially be better. The guys at the top, Michael Porter and Luka Doncic, and so Yeah, they could, you know, they could get faults this year, and that could completely change the direction of the organization, pull in somebody else next year at the top of the draft, and all of a sudden they're a completely different team than the one we're looking at right now. So, yeah, I think those draft picks are really key. So I think that's really, that's sort of the pivot point for what they're going to be over the next couple of years.
Yeah, and like I said, I think their plans are going to revisit the Paul George and Butler thing, and hopefully they're going to try to get him on a steal and get him for a lot cheaper price. So, my man Steve Lutsky, Steve LN6 at Steve LN6 wants to know. He saw Biombo and Adams have breakout series last year. What role player do you think can explode this in these playoffs? He asked specifically Thon Maker or Kelly Oubre.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's a good one. I'll say maybe Clint Capella has a coming out party, which he already kind of is. I actually wrote about him last summer, how, you know, he was a perfect replacement for Dwight. Didn't want the post-ups, you know, pogo stick, liked to get up and down, can block a few shots. I think defensively he's probably been a little underwhelming this year, but, I mean, the guy's, he's like 21, 22. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe, he's going to probably show out the rest of the series against OKC and kind of have a breakout. That's an easy one. Low foot, low hanger.
Yeah. I think Utah's maybe going to surprise the Clippers. Was talking about this today that I would lean towards, of all the scenarios, I would lean towards right now maybe the Jazz winning and really just sort of blowing this open, blowing the Clippers apart. Derek Favors, Gordon Hayward, two guys have been really good for a while, and maybe the national NBA fans haven't gotten a chance to see that much because they're in Utah. And then maybe somebody else off their bench, like Joe Ingles, has been fantastic this year. He's probably not going to have those big eye-popping games where he's putting up 30 points.
He locked up J.J. Redick the other day. He did a phenomenal job on J.J. Redick.
Yeah, so he's definitely going to help them have a strong playoff series. Maybe still incognito at the end of the season, but yeah, maybe somebody from Utah.
Good call. I like that one. Is Derek Favors all right? He looked like he was laboring. The hip was bothering him. Was it just fatigue the other night? What do you think?
I think it was a little fatigue. You know, he missed so many games this year, and he's going to be asked to. He's going to be asked to do a lot, filling in for Gobert, and then especially in this, you know, this particular series matching up with Jordan and Griffin in the front court. You know, it's going to be asking a lot for him, but, he's probably the perfect player to step in and fill that role. The nice thing about Utah is they've got this depth, they've got this versatility, so it's not like they need him to come in and play like Gobert played. You know, they can have him come in, sort of be the kind of player that he is, and they can sort of flex and adapt around him. And, you know, I don't think it puts them necessarily at a huge disadvantage.
A couple of years ago, even though Rudy was still great, I remember the defensive numbers with Rudy on or off and with Derek Favors filling at center were identical. So that's a luxury that they have there in Utah to have big men of that caliber.
Yeah.
So my man David Fernandez is at @the_Fernandula. He wants to know which team from the East and from the West, who missed the playoffs this year, will make it next season and why. So that's a good question. So we got the Heat, Pistons, Hornets, Knicks, Orlando, Philly, Brooklyn in the East, and then Nuggets, Hornets, Dallas, Sacramento, I guess we'll go Minnesota too in the West. Give me your West first. Who do you think? Who's going to get it next year?
Probably the Nuggets. I mean, they were right there, and I think a full season with Jokic starting. I think a little more time. They've sort of figured out their identity, and you know they're gonna be able to flesh out their roster a little bit more this year. So I think a full year of continuity is going to really do them wonders.
Okay, so who falls out?
Man, I think probably Memphis could fall out, and I think there's a chance that the Clippers are headed for sort of a big roster shakeup if things don't work out for them in the playoffs this year. So we could be looking at, you know, a totally different rebuilt Clippers team next year.
You guys heard it here first. Hickory High told us that. No, that's a good. How about East? Who do you think in the East is going to make it next year that didn't make it this year?
Miami, I guess. They're I don't know. I mean,
You sound like I'm Ron Burgundy.
I don't feel great about the future necessarily, or like the immediate future necessarily for any of those teams in the East. I think, you know, Philly and Brooklyn are definitely like heading in the right direction. Miami, it seems like they could be drastically different this year. You know, a lot of those guys who played big roles for them this year might not be back. And you know, some of those guys like Dragic, as good as he was this year, just because of his age, he's probably not, you know, necessarily part of their long-term plan. So it seems like they could make some moves this year and could, you know, sort of come into a very different roster. But, you know, they also have a lot of those young pieces, Tyler Johnson and Josh Richardson and, you know, Justice Winslow for a whole season. Sounds like Spoelstra has some big plans for him. So, yeah, I guess Miami maybe is the team I'd look at to step up.
Who drops out?
Wouldn't surprise me if the Pacers dropped out. Wouldn't surprise me if Paul George has a new home next year and they're a step back. The Hawks, same thing too. You know, if they end up moving Millsap, I think they, you know, might not be a playoff team next year. Bulls, you know, with or without Butler, it seems like there's pathways for them to not be a playoff team next year.
Yeah, I feel bad for Butler. They need to get him a real team in there. So I'm gonna go. I think Charlotte has last few years has a it's like clockwork. They make the playoffs, then they miss the playoffs. Then they make the playoffs. This year they miss. They're gonna make the playoffs again next year. And I think falling out is gonna be the Hawks. I think Millsap's gonna be gone this summer, and they're gonna fall apart. And then the West, I'm with you. Yeah, it's gonna be the Nuggets. Nuggets are gonna make it in. And yeah, the Memphis Grizzlies, I think, are. It's so hard, though, to say that with Conley and Marc Gasol, but I'm looking at the rest of the West, and, yeah, it's got to be them. So, yeah. Yep, that's going to be it. That's it for that. So I think we got one more question, and we'll wrap this up. This is an easy one, too. What would Isaiah Thomas and Markel Fultz backcourt look like in real life? I think it's too small. I don't know, man. That's just too many guards. Avery Bradley, Marcus Smart, Terry Rozier, which, I mean, finally, I guess I had to move out for him, but... That's just so many guards. That's all right, but I mean, we already, you know, I think the backcourt's already so small. They need size back there, so I'm not a big fan of that. I heard Markel Fultz said that him and Isaiah have been talking about playing together, like, you know, like they kind of want it, but I don't know, man. What do you think?
Yeah, I think maybe they can make it work. I think. Fultz's defense is going to hurt them. Like, obviously he has a lot of defensive potential, but I don't think he plays with that sort of intensity and aggressiveness that Bradley does right now. It's certainly not the refinement. So swapping him in and making him play, you know, off guard, moving out Avery Bradley, moving him to the bench or trading him, I think, you know, probably hurts their defense a bunch. Offensively, I think they'd be fine. Both Thomas and Fultz, have great jump shots, would be real outside threats. I think the offense would survive. I think maybe the best solution if they end up with Fultz is finding a taker for Terry Rozier and having Fultz be that third guard off the bench. So, you know, maybe he's running point with Marcus Smart or with Avery Bradley, or, you know, maybe he's playing next to Isaiah Thomas, just sort of more mix and match back there. And, you know, I guess you got to sort of work that out in the pre-draft process, whether, you know, Fultz is willing to come in and spend, you know, 2 or 3 years, the beginning of his career, being sort of a complimentary piece on a team that's, you know, trying to become a championship contender, or whether he, you know, wants to come in and play 35 minutes a game and get his shots and whatever. But I think, I don't know how much this has been talked about, but just, you know, that Washington connection, it seems like Isaiah Thomas and Avery Bradley have a tight connection, and, you know, Fultz being from that area as well, too, like, yeah, there might be something there, you know, where those guys sort of feel like kindred spirits and are willing to, you know, make things work.
Yeah, it's just too many guards, and it's not what we need, so whatever, you're making me depressed all over. So, you got anything coming on that you want to plug? Anything you got working on right now?
The Anti Awards, which are something I've been doing for a couple of years. I go back to the old Hickory High days, but it's awards for the worst statistical achievements of the year. So it's, you know, the guy with the most turnovers in a game, the player 6'10" or taller with the lowest total rebound percentage, the guy 6'10" or taller got the highest percentage of his shots blocked this year. So it's always a lot of fun. I enjoy writing it and sort of looking at some of the sadder stats of the season. So that'll be up at Nylon Calculus.
Dope. I'm looking forward to it, my brother. Where can people find you then? The Nylon Calculus, fansided.com, and you're still on social media. They can find you at Hickory High, correct?
That is, yeah, at Hickory High, and yeah, all the NBA verticals at Fansided, I'll be splashed all over them.
You are the man, Ian. Thank you for coming on, my brother, and sorry to keep you so long.
No problem, it was fun. There.
Burn no, it was midnight good. Oil. I'd love to have you on again this summer sometime.
Absolutely, just let me know.
Or during the playoffs, and I'll make sure it's at a better hour or two. I won't keep you up so late.
No worries.
Thank you, my man. I appreciate it.
He told him that I was the bleep, bleep, bleep truth.
I knew the kid can play, but I didn't know he can play like that.
And that'll do it for this episode of The Truth for the Almighty Baller Radio Network. And for Dash, this is James Holis. Follow me on Twitter. At Snotty Drippin', which is like Scottie Pippin, but with S, N, and whatever. Snotty Drippin', you'll find it. And we'll talk to you guys next week.
You snotty bastard.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!